This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'd like now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Nigel Taplin. He's head of the Rio Grande School here in Santa Fe, and we're here to talk about education. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me, Mary Charlotte. Good morning.
Great to have you, and we're broadcasting from the school today, where I have just seen a really quite beautiful experience of these young kids engaged in a lot of different kinds of learning. You come from England, and you come from a very different type of learning than what the children are doing here. And in a way, the kind of education that you believe in is a contrast and perhaps even reaction to
Right. Where
you come from.
Yeah, my father was a pilot in the Royal Air Force and moved all over the world, and my parents felt that the children, myself and my two siblings, should be placed in a school where we would have some continuity. So we went to boarding school. I went to boarding school at the age of 7 all the way through 17, and then took a year off and taught for a year, actually, and then went to university. The whole culture there at the time, very formal. Not like the culture in America, which is really what attracted me to America in the first place, actually, was just the openness and the informality, rather than... It's not where you're born, not what you're born into. It's who you are. So it's very much a sort of a merit-based attitude here when I came here in 1982. And in schools, the difference is that the informality leads to engagement, leads to respect for the individual. So in this context, our little people here, the students, are supported by the big people, who are the educators, the administration. I hate that term, by the way, administration, and parents. So what the big people do is support the little people, but we give them the respect that they really need and deserve to grow and develop into big people. And so we come at it through the learner. It's what many call student-centered learning. You come at it through the learner, so it's not so much top-down, even though there is some of that, obviously, but it's coming through the learner, creating bridges as to who that learner is and where that learner is in his or her journey developmentally, and building those bridges all the time. And in that way, the learner, the child, the student connects with it and engages with it, and it makes complete sense. And through the social emotional learning program here, which is the heart and soul of any good school, where the focus is on who am I as an individual, what is my responsibility, what am I accountable for, how do I engage as an individual with the group, and vice versa. So you've got that atmosphere here, that ethos here, that allows the child, the learner, to really take emotional risks and really engage and be really curious without hesitating, without being pulled back by some social issue. Not that that doesn't happen, of course it happens, but that's the key here. And back in the UK, that was like, might as well have been on the moon. I mean, that was none of that was even talked about.
Right. And I think that kind of British learning, which, I mean, for me, having grown up partly in New England, I think that England-New England connection is pretty tight. And the idea that a child's emotions would play a role in their education was unheard of.
Right, exactly. And not to say that my own experience didn't have its pluses. Of course it did. I mean, I came out with a lot of knowledge, and I was exposed to a lot of sports and that kind of thing. But really, this whole child enriched, student-centered approach to engaging the community, which is what a good school does. It is a community. And sometimes we talk about it, you know, the student, this is home away from home kind of environment, you know, where they feel safe at home.
Yeah.
They feel safe here. And it's absolutely key.
Let's talk a little bit more about safety.
Yeah.
There's so much fear among students who, for example, go to big urban schools where there's metal detectors, where there's guns, where there's drugs, where there's a kind of jungle that many of us who went to school decades ago can't even imagine what that's like. So I don't know how much of that we have in, this is an elementary school, Rio Grande, how much of that kind of sense of unsafety we have in the elementary schools. But let's talk more about safety. What does safety mean? How do you cultivate an atmosphere of safety in a school, especially in a school for young people?
Well, first of all, you've got to have the physical safety piece. That has to be in place. So the parents have to feel that they can say goodbye to their children at the beginning of the day and not have to worry about the physical safety. So the school has to get that right. And you're right, finding that balance between, having a security guard with a weapon or even having, an administrator with a weapon, which is being talked about. Which actually came out of the Newtown, the Sandy Hook. There was a lot of talk about that in my last school, and it was complete rejection of that, fortunately. And so you have to have that physical safety before you can get at the emotional safety. And then, again, it's foundational and core to a good school's mission. And this school's mission is that emotional intelligence, that social and emotional intelligence is the focus. And with our youngest coming in at the age of three, that is essentially the program, allowing that to flow as these young people are trying to figure out their relationships. They're trying to figure out, oh, I want that. How am I going to get that? Or I need to communicate something. How am I going to do that? And just learning to be an individual within a group, but really feeling supported. And we use the word nurture with young children, right? With older children, you wouldn't use the word nurture. You would use the word advocate, I think. So upper, middle, and high school children, you advocate for them, or they self-advocate. Here, the educators are nurturing, supporting, and so the learner can really feel supported and honored and celebrated.
Yeah.
And that's, you put the two together, the physical safety with that, and what you have here is a thriving community of the children, the little people, and the big people, the parents included. The parents are key. This is a partnership. Because we really home in on the fact that the parents know their child better than anybody else. The educators are trained, and the two come together in a partnership, working together, constantly communicating. If you hit a blip, you rely on that, the confidence that you have in one another, that your focus is in the best interest of the child, of the parent's child, of the student. And that comes together very, very well. And what happens is that we thrive as a community because the parents feel that you could put it in more crass terms, the value proposition is there for them. They want their child to be celebrated. They want their child to be known. They want their child to be educated. The faculty are completely committed to that, and the faculty reflect the mission of the school, and they're on the same page with what we're trying to do in every single aspect of what we're trying to do here, whether it's the social-emotional program or teaching reading or math or whatever it might be. We're all on the same page with that. And so what we have here is a thriving community of engaged children and engaged adults.
Now, when you bring in a teacher, let's say that teacher has a teaching certificate, maybe has a specialty in science or arts or whatever, what kind of training do you, as a school, give that teacher so that they fit into the mission and the sort of vibe and ethos of the school?
Well, the first thing is that when we look to hire an educator here, by the way, we use the term, I'm really promoting the term educator. Teacher's too narrow. Because you can't teach without doing your research and your planning. So that's why I like to use that broader term of educator. So when we're looking at an educator here, we have a search committee that I'm a part of, and that's comprised of other faculty members. So we really have to understand whether this potential educator here has the mindset, you know, loves to be with children, really enjoys being with children, and thrives in a child-centered and a student-centered environment. That's first, and then of course the qualifications are important. I mean, they have to have a degrees, minimally a bachelor's degree, hopefully in something around education, but it doesn't necessarily have to be that. So you've got those sort of qualifications, but really we're looking at their educational philosophy. Does their educational philosophy fit our student-centered approach to learning? We wouldn't connect with someone who's very top-heavy, very sort of directive, very adult-centered. That wouldn't work for us, even though, yes, we are an adult, you know, we guide the children. Certainly the children are not running loose here, but that's really important. And then in terms of programmatically, any educator coming in, we send them off right away in training in responsive classroom.
What's responsive classroom?
So responsive classroom originates in New England. It's our social, it's our formal social emotional curriculum. It's our formal curriculum. Of course, we have an informal curriculum as well. So they're trained in that. Again, that reflects our belief that it's foundational, that the social emotional. So with a new faculty member coming in, a new educator coming in, being trained in that, that person then begins the school year understanding what we're trying to do across the school and vertically throughout the school in terms of what our expectations are, what our, you know, using a common language, and so on and so forth. Otherwise, you know, the educator coming in, just depending on where that educator is, you know, they generally fit in, they have a mentor, but they generally fit in really well because, you know, they've got the experience and they're connecting with our educational philosophy. And so the fit, it's a good fit. Of course, we have associate educators here as well. So every educator coming in would have an associate of some form and some presence there. So that person can also act as a guide and as a mentor. And we put a lot of time into professional development. A lot of time into that. That comes back to that educator term, that researcher and planner. And in fact, right now, the school's undergoing a complete curriculum review. We launched that on February the 12th. And the key for that is complete faculty ownership. So we spent several months figuring out how we were going to approach it. Faculty run, had a faculty task force, which I was a part of. And we've engaged in that. And we're really digging down into our educational philosophy, our educational tenets as to what learning is all about within the Rio Grande mission and what we believe. And that's actually a 3-year project as we go through everything and culminating in deep alignment of, or realignment if necessary, of what we're trying to do here curricularly.
We're talking to Nigel Taplin, head of the Rio Grande School here in Santa Fe. There are so many different educational philosophies, and they change from one decade to the next and from one generation to the next. And there's a lot of focus now on social and emotional learning that wasn't there before. It hasn't really caught up so much, I think, quite to the public schools, although maybe there are some progressive public schools right now. I've heard a number of people in more of the private school setting talking about these things. And when you talk about it, there is this question, and I think everybody's asking this question in every school board and board of education and public school administration and private school, preparing kids to be adults, preparing kids to enter society, what kind of preparation is necessary? And I think there's a kind of slightly panicked, competitive feeling that sometimes people bring to that question. It's like, we have to prepare them to compete. We have to prepare them economically. We have to prepare them to get good jobs. And then a lot of people, when they go down that road, try to bring as much technology and as many gadgets as possible into the school so that they're computer literate and that kind of thing. And it makes me a little bit nervous because society is changing so fast that preparing people for one specific thing, who knows what society is going to be like when those kids graduate from high school or college anyway. So how do you see this question of what you are preparing them for? I mean, this is early childhood through sixth grade, so you're preparing them to go to middle school and high school. But in the bigger picture, What does that preparation look like for you? How do you think about it?
The way we think about it is that at Rio Grande, we're educating in the present for the future. And so we spend a lot of time thinking about that future. And I'm not talking about seventh grade. I'm talking about seventh grade and beyond, college and beyond. As we look at ourselves as being, we are an elementary school, and so it's foundational, early childhood elementary. So the mindset here is we are all about foundational. We're about instilling foundational values.
What kind of values?
Well, you know, again, it comes back to the social emotional programming. I mean, even basic values in terms of saying good morning. Like, you know, I walk past you in the hallway, let's just say, and go, "Good morning, Mary Charlotte."
Right.
And I look you right in the eye, and I expect the person I'm speaking to, most of the time a student, to say, "Well, good morning, Mr. Taplin." Not just say hi, but say, "Good morning, Mr. Taplin," or some similar greeting, but give me eye contact. I mean, all the way from basic manners, opening doors, you know, all those very traditional manners that I was certainly brought up with, you know, the formal side, perhaps.
Which have a real place.
Which are really, really important, because when you're out there interviewing for jobs and that kind of thing, I mean, it's still important as to how, you know, you look the person in the eye. I mean, I always talk about the three tens when I'm talking to students. So it's the first 10 words that come out of your mouth. It's the top 10, you know, your chin up, you know, in other words, your look, and it's the energy, your first 10 steps towards that person. So, I mean, again, that's just an example of very, you know, you never throw the baby out with the bathwater. Raising children, you don't throw the baby out of the bathwater. So those very important manners and etiquette and how to behave with others is really, really important. And in this day and age, when so many of our children are staring, you know, in front of a screen or interacting with some kind of technology, I worry about that. I really do. So Rio Grande has the technology as an example of this, but it's thoughtfully integrated into the learning. But going back to your question, this is a time of huge, great anxiety. This country is worried. You know, we're worried about losing our leadership in the world. We're worried about globalization. We're worried about our safety, terrorism. We're worried about our safety locally.
We're worried about climate change. We're worried about pollution.
Climate change, pollution, we're worried about our financial world after the Great Recession that occurred. So there are a lot of worries there, and those translate into parents often being very anxious as well. So again, coming back to this foundational view that we have on education, let's peel that back and, again, not throwing the baby out with the bathwater, but come down to our values and how we treat one another. And at the other end of this continuum is, what are some of those outcomes, again coming back to your question, that a good elementary school is looking for? And so it's not only the manners, it's not only how you present yourself, even though that's very important, because one of our five core skills is speaking. So that's representing yourself, could be in a one-on-one, a conversation, could be making a presentation to a group or to a class, or as our sixth graders are about to do on Friday afternoon at 1:30, they're giving their graduation speech, which is a culmination beginning at the age of three, where they were involved in all school meetings, concerts, or class presentations. I mean, you know, I was just watching the kindergartners earlier in the year giving their formal presentations. You know, so it all begins somewhere within this, and it culminates with being a confident communicator.
Right.
And that also includes reading and writing. So, you know, and math and numbers. So again, when I went to school, the three R's were key. I mean, that was the big focus, all right? I would still argue that it needs to continue to be. So our outcomes in that sort of context are very strong. I mean, our students do very well in reading and writing and math. And we know that because we use the standardized test, the ERB, the CTP4, which is very rigorous. And we start that in third grade, so we track it. and our children do very well on one assessment piece, formal assessment piece, on that test. And so, and then when they go on, whether it's Santa Fe Prep or Desert Academy, St. Michael's, wherever they go, we know that the children are well prepared because we get that feedback. And in fact, we track them going into college and so on. So we know that what we're doing here works, not to say that we're not always tweaking it and looking to improve it.
We're talking to Nigel Taplin of the Rio Grande School. And one of the things that you do here that I found really interesting is the kids get trained in having a bank account. It's very sort of hands-on because they do it in the context of the classroom. So they have this sort of like fake money, but they spend it and do silent auctions. You showed me some kids did fundraising because they wanted to buy a little ball court thing.
A Gaga court.
Yeah, yeah. Gaga court. And I didn't even know what Gaga was. I still don't exactly. But anyway, but it's a little court, and the kids raised their own money. And this is the kind of thing that many of us didn't learn until we were in our 30s or later. And so, well, what does that look like? How do you do it? And how did this come about?
Well, it comes about because, again, education doesn't occur in a vacuum. So why are we, as parents, why are we raising our children? As educators, what are we trying to do here in partnership? Well, our goal is to prepare the children, the child, to be productive, successful, fulfilled, whatever words you use, as a goal. And so that has a real world implication. And the vacuum here is that often schools forget that the children are not going to stay in your school for the rest of their lives, that school's actually pretty artificial. Because a lot of the time you're surrounded by four walls and a roof. You know, that's part of the experience, but that's not what you're really preparing them for. So you contextualize it and say, okay, using the fourth grade example about the bank account, for instance, that actually is all about responsibility and accountability, but it's connecting them to a real world function, which is managing money. So I'm paid $100 a month or whatever it is, and how am I going to use that money? And I may lose some of that money if I don't fulfill a certain task that I've been assigned to. So, you know, and the children in the fourth grade are given tasks. And part of the reason for that is it helps the class function. So they're taking ownership for their, these are fourth graders, but they're taking ownership for their own classroom and environment, which you extend that's what you want them to do as they grow through upper middle school and high school and college and life. You want them to take ownership and responsibility, and you want to give them the real world tools to be able to do that. The Gaga court, the students, sixth grade students came out to me at the beginning of the year after having experienced it at the Glorieta Conference Center, and they loved this game, and it originates from Israel. And I said, well, and they said, well, we want to have it here. And I said, well, it's not, how are we going to get it here? It's not going to fall out of a tree or out of the sky. And they said, well, we need to raise money, right? And I said, okay, go away and write me a business plan. So working with Jennifer Jackson, who's the fifth, sixth grade language arts educator, they, with the several renditions, they came up with a business plan. And they fulfilled it, and they raised $1,400. No parent contributed. No, they actually raised the money. They identified the Gaga court they wanted. They ordered it. Once they'd raised the money, it came in, and they assembled it. And the whole school now plays it at recess. And that is, you know, one thing is this is sixth graders taking responsibility. It's sort of part of their capstone, their culminating year experience here. Again, taking responsibility and role modeling. And this community has benefited from that. And there are so many examples of that going on here in what I would call a real-world educational environment.
One of the things that you have, and that's a very key part of this, is small school, small classrooms, around maybe 20 kids per class. And that is something that I think has been pretty well-researched to be extremely effective and very important. And it's something that public schools don't have the opportunity to do because there's too many kids and too little funding. When you think about education in the big picture, what are your ideas for, I mean, you're running this school, it's fantastic, but you know, how do you get these ideas out into the world in a bigger way?
Well, what's most important in life? You know, it's family, it's health, and it's education, I think. And I don't believe that as a society we talk about that enough and really spend time asking the questions, are we doing a good job with family? Are we doing a good job with health? And are we doing a good job with education? We're very fortunate here at Rio Grande School in the fact that we have a very low student-educator ratio. So you mentioned, for instance, let's use the fourth grade again as an example. You know, you've got Kristen Potter, who's the lead full-time educator in there, fantastic educator, with Teddy Kret as her associate, who's half-time. And the two of them work together, and Teddy's there to hit those critical parts of the day, tending to be around the 5 R's, the speaking, listening, reading, writing, and math. But we're fortunate to have those resources to be able to do that. I wish public schools could also do the same, but it's a lot harder for public schools because we have a mission and we won't accept every child that comes through the door because we may not necessarily have the resources to be able to, we may not benefit the child. You know, any time we make an admissions decision, it's always in the interest of the child. Does the child have every chance of thriving here? You know, and that's a mission question.
So it's like, is this child a good fit for this school?
School, yes. Yeah. It's not only the child, it's the parents. Because the parents have to have the educational, have to have the philosophy of parenting and the educational philosophy for this to work well and have to be invested in and engaged with their child's education here. I mean, that's the key, the big people really engaging together around the little people, around the students. Public schools, it's a whole different issue. And, you know, public schools take everybody, which is what they should. And, you know, and then you've got politics, you've got having to be accountable to the legislature. I mean, there are so many things that public schools have to deal with. You know, it's very challenging. And a lot of public schools around here, I mean the ones locally, the elementary schools locally I visited, one I haven't got to Wood Gormley yet, but I visited the others. I mean, they do a really good job, I think. I mean, they really do. I just had Kate, who's the principal at Adelaide, here yesterday, and we had a wonderful conversation where she's taking her school is great.
So there's some communication among the public and private schools.
Well, I'm a huge, huge proponent of that. I wish we could get together more because, you know, it's about choice, and I'm a big believer in choice. And private schools have a role here as a choice, and the public schools themselves have choices. You know, you've got the Mandela School, for instance, which is an IB program. It's not yet authorized, I don't believe, but it's an IB approach, which is fantastic.
International Baccalaureate,
yeah,
IB.
Yes, you know. So, you know, I mean, you've got choices within the public schools, and each, what I'm understanding here locally, the elementary schools have their own personality. So if you're not in the zone, you can interzone, potentially. And, you know, there's some really good things going on and some good thinking. And each of us is hopefully pushing each other to offer the very best we can within our mission. And Rio Grande's, you know, works very hard at delivering the value proposition.
Let's talk about the component of outdoor learning. That's part of what you do too, whether it's getting off campus or being on campus but outdoors.
Yeah. Again, learning is, it's such a wonderful, the term learning means so much. And, you know, going back to the core, the listening, speaking, reading, writing, and numbers, math, you can get at that in so many different ways through project-based learning, thematic learning, design thinking, those kinds of approaches. We have a very interesting program here as well, run by Stu Pendleton, who's fabulous with the children. It's bringing the classroom experience alive. It's an experiential kind of experience that he takes outdoors, where there is that social emotional piece going on, where the students are challenged to learn to work together on some kind of classroom related outdoor project that also encompasses the environment. So the children are connected with the environment. So it could be on campus, it could be up in the hills, depending on what Stu's trying to do. It could be down at the Santa Fe River, could be with the Audubon, it could be with the Botanic Garden. Wherever it is very important, particularly in this day and age generation where you've got such a big influence of technology, that the children connect with their environment. And of course, you know, we've got climate issues out there as well. So it's connecting all of that. And then we've got the solar panel demonstrations that we were gifted, that we've just installed. So you've got all these connections. So that's solar energy, and how does that connect? But this adventure-based learning program is really neat, and obviously the students love it. So, for instance, in third grade, they were doing a geography, topographical project, and so Stu took them out just north of us here, and east of us here, and took them on a hike. So they were hiking through the mountains, which in itself was an experience, connecting with that, what they were hiking through, and then got up to the plateau, and then with the topography piece, brought that to life with identifying whatever it was they were doing, mountains, plateaus, mesas, you know, whatever it might be, river basins and so on, up there above us, looking over the valley, and then hiking back down. You know, so that might have been an hour and a half, 2 hour lesson, class. Wow, isn't that rich?
Well, especially if you're not only hiking, but you're learning to observe, and then you're connecting that to the things that are in the classroom.
Exactly, exactly. And then it comes back to the classroom, and they reflect. So this is another thing that we, you know, sometimes we don't do enough, is that pause, reflection. I mean, you saw the third grade doing a sort of like a mindfulness kind of activity. Remember when I tried to get into the classroom and Ellie came up and said, Nigel, close the door.
And they had their eyes closed, and they were in a kind of imagination space.
Imagery, yes.
About to go into a writing
activity.
Yeah.
And there's more research on that we lose imagination, that we become so focused on data or so focused on what we need to do and so content heavy that, you know, these children who come in at 3, 4, 5 year olds with all this imagination, that the system knocks that out of them.
Yeah.
So being imaginative, being creative, it's part of these deeper learning skills that are so important and that we need to nurture. But in that particular activity, she was really connecting them with what they needed to do. A classic example is, you know, I'm a teacher in the classroom, teacher, not an educator, teacher in the classroom, and I'm asking questions. Do I give my students enough time to think about their response? Because children's minds think differently and doesn't mean they're less capable. So it's just being aware of all these different nuances about learning. Well, nuances is an understatement, but how the mind works, and that goes back to our research as educators and putting together this program that really makes sense.
We're talking to Nigel Taplin, head of the Rio Grande School here in Santa Fe. It's an elementary school from early childhood. I guess the youngest kids are about 3 years old, going through the sixth grade. And I wanted to pick up on something that you said, which was that kids just naturally learn very differently. I remember I have a friend whose young son was in a school where they had really brought back kind of hands-on learning and doing crafts. And so they had to not only do their report, but bind it as a book. And a lot of the kids really loved this and took to it, because that whole, I loved that stuff when I was young, you know, the handcraft part of it. And her son hated it. He couldn't do it. He got glue all over his hair. He just could not do it. And so there was this, like, there is no one mode of learning or way of expressing what you've learned that's right for every kid. And there's variation in every classroom. How do you deal with those different kids?
Well, and that's the value proposition that we have here, in that we're able to, I mean, the term is differentiation. So that's not individualization. It's meeting the needs of each child, each learner, of all of our learners, without individualizing. So it's not a one-on-one. So we do that. You know, the educators really get to know the children really well. I meet with the educators every other week during one of their free periods where the children may be doing performing arts or something like that, and we sit down and we go through every child.
You one-on-one with each?
Like, for instance, when you were in, say, with Kirsty in second grade there, I sit down with Kirsty and Katie, and I've got Kerry with me, who's our learning support coordinator as well, and we circle and we talk about each child, and if any child is having a particular issue, we talk that through and how we're going to move the child forward. Do we bring the parents in or not, or whatever it might be, learning support around that child. So yeah, I mean, every child learns differently, and the program is so multimodal that we're able to not only help those students who may not necessarily be good visual learners, let's just say, but being a good visual learner is important, just like it is with being an auditory learner or a kinesthetic learner. So you know, we're able to focus on multimodal approaches to learning.
So let's take that example. When you say good visual learner, do you mean somebody who learns through reading?
Yeah.
So let's
or
say
watching.
Reading or watching. So let's say somebody just isn't a good reader. How do you think about that? Do you think, well, let's help them learn in other ways, or let's help make them a better reader?
Yeah, so again, it comes back to engagement, right? So you want not every child is a natural reader or is interested in reading. And so you introduce, and again, the research shows this, you introduce, it's not the level of the reading that's important to begin with, it's interesting the learner in reading. So again, by knowing the child is the way we do, and by having a wonderful resource here with our library, as well as all the resources within the classroom, you can generally, most of the time, you can connect the child to an interest that he or she might be interested in, say, with literature, with reading, and then they're supported around that. So again, it comes back to differentiation. You won't find all children reading the same book, let's just say, for instance.
So like if a kid is really into horses, but not into reading, but you give them a book about horses.
Horses, yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the way. I mean, that's not a secret, and that's the way all good schools do it. And but we spend a fair amount of time with reading because we believe that reading is really critical and foundational for, obviously, for writing, but yeah, but for thinking and thinking critically, being an inquirer and thinking a discoverer and thinking critically as well. So again, going back to your question, we work very hard at meeting the needs of all of our learners here, and understanding that we all learn differently, and we have areas that we, turn to more naturally than others, ways of learning.
Tell us a little bit more about your own history as an educator. I mean, you said you came from England and were sent to boarding school at a very young age,
right?
And there were some things about the British system that worked for you, and a lot of things that didn't. What happened then? You became an adult. What did you want to do?
Well, it's interesting because my second boarding school, I was really into sports as well, and at that time rugby. And the rugby coach asked me to help him coach, and I loved it. And I graduated a little bit younger. I wasn't old enough to go to college because I had to be 18. Go to university, so I took a year off, and I taught for a year. I didn't have a clue what I was doing, but I was sort of like an intern down in southeast England, just south of London, at this, what we call there a prep school, what's called here a pre-prep, 7-year-olds to 13-year-olds. And I taught general knowledge, English, and I coached sports. And I did that for a year, and I loved it. So thanks to this teacher, he's a math teacher at my boarding school. He often we talk about those people who've had a big influence on your life, and he was the one that really got me interested in coaching and then teaching, when the two are very similar. And that led me going to university and getting into teaching. And then I taught at a school in northwest London for 5 years. But in the meantime, I came to this country for 2 summers in 76 and 78 as a camp counselor in the Poconos. And I traveled all over the country and I loved it. I just loved the openness and just, you know, the physical beauty all over the country and just the attitude here. And it really attracted me. And the family who I taught their sons in London went to UCLA, went to LA, and they gave me names of a couple of schools, and one of them had an English headmaster, actually, and he hired me over in L.A., and I was thinking I'm just going to go for a year, and I ended up, met Susie, who's ironically of Pennsylvania, because that's where I did my camp counseling, right next to her town in the Poconos, ended up staying and have lived the sort of this American dream. I mean, I've really lived it, you know, and of course I go back to the U.K., and I'm an American now, and all of that. And so I'm very integrated here. I love the country and fascinated by it still. But being an educator, you know, is what drives me, is trying to make a difference. And with other wonderful educators that we have here, you know, we're all on a mission here to do the very best we can for the children and to really be thoughtful about it.
Do you feel like, and you've been with a number of different schools over the course of your career, that you do what you can for one school and get it to a certain point and then move on to a new one? I mean, is that how it works?
Sort of. I mean, there are things that can sometimes get in the way of that. But, you know, it just depends where you are in your career and where you're going as well. I mean, I taught for many years and wanted to get into school leadership. So that dictated a move in LA, actually, to another school. And then, you know, doing that administrative was more a recruitment, admissions, marketing, and then wanting to get into academic leadership. So that led to being an assistant head at two schools, one being on the East Coast in Connecticut, where, you know, I learned from wonderful mentors and, you know, really experienced a lot of different things, you know, a curriculum review, working with faculty, working with program design, working with parents and all of that, and eventually became a head of school and helped that school and got to a point where I felt that I needed to leave. I mean, help build it. And, you know, so it just depends where you are on that school's journey and where your career is going. And here, you know, what attracted me here was that it was small and I could be more hands-on. I could be more involved with the children, more involved with the faculty, rather than being in a bigger school where you get distracted by a lot of other things, fundraising and other things. I wanted to be closer to it. And, you know, and I'm getting towards the end of my career. I don't know when that'll be, but, you know, and Santa Fe's beautiful. You know, it's slower than Phoenix, let's just say, you know, for instance, the environment is, you know, clean air and so many other things that work that sort of contribute to, you know, being happy here, and then, you know, facing the challenges of being in an independent school. I mean, your tuition is not low here. I mean, it costs us over $18,000. Well, the tuition is over $18,000 for K-6. Costs us more than that, you know, but that has to be workable while you're trying to diversify the student body socioeconomically, culturally, as much as possible.
And you do have scholarships for some of the kids.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, we're close to knocking on the door of 30% of our children, our families are on tuition assistance. You know, again, that's important for our own children to be in an environment that's as heterogeneous, so to speak, as diverse as possible, while, you know, the school, integrating the school in the community, into the Santa Fe community as much as possible. And we've been doing a lot of work in that area as well as connecting with the Native American, you know, the Pueblos, for instance, the Powaqui. We have a wonderful relationship with the Powaqui. The governor, Joe, is a parent. You know, but we, you know, we work hard on that because we believe in that. And it's part of our children's education to understand their own heritage. So we're living here in Santa Fe, New Mexico. What is our heritage? What is our history? Yeah. And understanding that and being able to connect in real world with that, as well as understanding what it is to be an American and so on. And that goes back to the conversation about the globalization and what you do with that. So again, within the context of being foundational.
Yeah, it's, I mean, what is so painful, I think, to so many people is everybody wants a first-rate education for their children, pretty much. And a school like this is not going to be available to every person in Santa Fe. I mean, yes, there are some scholarships, but there's a total of 160 children in the whole entire school. And one can only hope that the conversation, and I mean, I think of it when you are talking, I think of the difference between a kind of reductionist science approach versus a kind of like mm-hmm. ecosystems thinking mm-hmm. science approach mm-hmm. to whatever it is that you're looking at, whether it be human health or whether it be education of children, that might filter out into the bigger system, and that kind of focus on and prioritizing of education and of really the highest quality human-centered education might eventually go into our public schools, and maybe the kids who are most at risk would have somebody thinking about them in a meeting once every other week, like, what is little Bobby or right. Sally or Josefina doing, and what are their challenges, and how can we help that individual child, not just for kids in private school, but for every kid.
No, I agree. I completely agree with that, Mary Charlotte. And, I mean, there are many, many wonderful educators in the public school system. You know, I meet them all the time. And, it's harder for them, as I've mentioned earlier, because of the mission that they are trying to fulfill there and everything else within that. Here we don't have to deal with, we are accredited and go through a very rigorous accreditation, so we're not pie in the sky by any means. We're held to certain standards, research-based. But we're different. And yes, it would be wonderful if all schools had the resources that we have. But what can Rio Grande School do as a member of this community to reach out to the community and be considered to be a valuable contributor to the health of the Santa Fe community? I mean, that's what I think is really, really important. And part of that is engaging with other elementary principals around here. I just mentioned Adelaya right next door. That to me is an important relationship to have.
Yeah.
And to be partners.
Well, the graduation at Rio Grande School is coming up this Friday.
Right.
And I want to thank you very much, Nigel Taplin, for being with us on the Radio Cafe. Nigel is head of the Rio Grande School. They are on the web at riograndeschool.org. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
And thank you for having me, Mary Charlotte. I really enjoyed meeting you and showing you around the school and being part of your program. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.